Good evening.
Last time we spoke in our series on Titus about negative traits. What should the elders not do? This time we're going to talk about positive traits, of which there are several. What should they do? Now, you might be saying to yourself, I am not an elder, and I don't really anticipate being an elder, so what does this message mean to me? Well, in the first place, all throughout the scriptures, and particularly the New Testament, we see leading by example. Jesus told his disciples, the Gentiles, exercise great authority, and they lord it over those underneath them. You are not to be like that. But if you want to be called great, you're going to be a servant. And so you're going to serve. And so as we look at these qualifications for elders, those of you who say, I'm probably not going to be an elder, or I'm not going to be a deacon, or I'm not going to be a pastor, these things, number one, are examples to follow. And number two, they're roads to service. These are things you need, like tools. So before I ever do any job, I gather my tools. Many times I make a list, especially if I'm going to leave home. So Nancy would tell you that I'd be chasing around at the last minute, checking off a list, saying, okay. And because it's very annoying to get somewhere and do something and not have the tools that you need. These are tools. And so I'm going to read a portion here from the scriptures and also a portion in very rough Greek that I borrowed from a translator so you can get a feel for the passage. Titus 1, starting in verse 5. For this reason I left you in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city, as I directed you. Namely, if a man is above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. For the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, not fond of sordid gain, but... That but is a key word, by the way. Hospitable, loving what is good, sensible, just, devout, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able both to exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict. And if we look at the more direct and rough translation, which I find interesting, it goes like this. For this course I left you behind in Crete, that you might further put in order the things which are lacking, and might establish in each city elders as I directed you. If anyone is unaccused, for it is necessary for the overseer to be unaccused as God's steward, husband of one wife, having believing children, not involved in accusation of dissoluteness or uncontrolled, not self-pleasing, not soon angry, not beside wine, not a striker, not shamefully greedy of gain, but hospitable, a lover of goodness, sound-minded, righteous, holy, self-controlled, holding firm to the faithful word in accord with the doctrine, in order that he may be able both to exhort in the teaching what is healthful and refute those contradicting. So Paul is turning now from the negative traits in the portion I am looking at to the positive traits, and there are six. Hospitality, lover of goodness, sound-minded, righteous, holy, self-controlled. And the but, prior to hospitable, is the transition. And you have the admonition against greed, and it sets up a contrast. Not this, but that. This is not what I want in the leadership. This is what I want. Greed is the enemy of hospitality. Greed is the enemy of giving others. So if you're sitting there thinking, what is greed? Are you thinking of Ebenezer Scrooge? Maybe. I'll give you an example. I knew some people one time, a friend of mine ran around with a boy, and there was a fellow that lived with his mother. He was kind of heavy set, not too nimble, and the mother was up in years. And they had a peach tree in the back of their house, and they asked me to come over. They had peaches way at the top of the tree, and they couldn't pick them. And they said they had all the peaches they wanted anyway. It was a good year. There was lots. So they said, come pick these peaches. They're just going to get ripe, and then they're going to fall on the yard and squash. So I said, okay, and I took a ladder over and propped it kind of up against the tree and squirreled up the ladder, and I picked the peaches. Now, while I was doing that, because, you know, I had small children at the time, and free peaches was a big deal to them. The peaches at the top were nice, and the old woman was seeing the peaches mount up in my basket, and she couldn't bear to let them go, so she brought a basket out. While I was at the top of the tree picking, she was at the bottom of the tree taking the peaches and carrying them inside. So anyway, when I finished, she'd taken a good many of the very best peaches, but she had some left for me. She told me, well, here, you could take these home. Now, the trees were really top-heavy, and they wanted me to come back and climb up in the trees and trim the top out because they couldn't do it. But I was disgusted. I never did go back. Greed is different things to different people, but greed is out there, okay? It's constantly grasping for more, okay? This hand is full. This hand is full. Can I shove this in my pocket and reach for more? It can inspire envy of the other person that might have something you want. I wish I had that. Or it can be the inability to see someone else get something, even though we have enough and to spare. Greed is not logical. I spent years in the union movement. I negotiated contracts from both sides of the table. And the greedy man is a man that would rather have 50 cents and you have nothing than both of you have a dollar. Because not only does he want to have some, he wants to have more than you. It's not logical. Or he'll fight against you getting something. So the linemen are up in the lines, and the shift workers are in the plant working 24 hours a day. They get a shift differential because they have to work Saturday, Sunday, holidays, rotating shifts, days, afternoon, nights. They're resentful about that differential. They said, when I get called out at night, why can't I get that? I said, when you get called out at night, you get paid time and a half. You get way more. Yeah, but I want that too. Why do they get it? Of course, they give up their whole life to do this job. Giving is part of the Christian life, should be part of every Christian life. Any and every Christian should be happy and delighted to give. God loves a cheerful giver. And you can learn to enjoy giving, which is contrary to human nature, as is much of the Christian life. Hospitable tells us the man is willing to share what he has, even at some sacrifice. You know, perhaps there's really not enough to share. But think of traveling. My wife had some relatives. Whenever we went there, she said, we can't stop there. You can never get away. They'd want us to eat supper. They want us to stay all night. I said to her, I'll give you some of my relatives that I can do without. I would take those. Oh, they're nice people. Hospitality was the lifeblood of the early church. if you think about it, because much different than the structure of our church that we have today. Evangelists were lodged in homes. The church met in the home of one of the members. The church building, the church parsonage didn't exist. Lord's Supper was celebrated in a home. The elements taken were doubtless furnished by someone in the church. So that was a whole different thing. The interaction with the public came in the atrium of the home. People might be in there waiting to buy olive oil from the man that owned the house, and here was a Christian service that they were listening to. What are these Christians all about? What do they do? Now, our church maintains a cottage at some cost in maintenance and utility and furnishings and provisions. And we do it for hospitality. And I've had more than one of the missionaries told me this is one of the great secrets of Western New York, this cottage back out here in the meadow where you get away from it all. Now, hospitable means a lover of travelers, a lover of others. You ever been to someone's house where, you know, you never got away without eating something? Hospitality. Now we enlarge that lover of goodness. The lover of goodness wants to know more about things or people that are good. He loves good things. You know, not just good things to eat, but good things. He wants to talk about, think about, and emulate good people. Okay? So perhaps he reads good books like the pastor is promoting. Oh, there's something good in this book. How do I know? Pastor told me there was something good. I think I'll read this and study it. I listen to various quotes that he gives from the pulpit, and I'm saying, now what book did that come out of? I've read that book. The one he made, I just couldn't remember which it was, but the Brains on a Stick one, that one I remembered. So the mind in thought and the body in action are focused on good things. It doesn't stop with the mind. Because a lot of people think, well, someday I'm going to do this or that for this person that's been good to me. And they get all aglow and they say, oh, it's be so great. But you know, someday never comes. You know? Perhaps you're never going to win the lottery and be able to give the guy a couple thousand dollars. You know? Take him out for coffee today. Tomorrow is uncertain. So this can stand as a test because there's a reaching out away from self-interest, okay, away from a narrow focus on me and mine to somebody else. What's good for them? You know, there's a quote from Wesley that I'm most fond of, and he says, do as much good as you can, wherever you can, in all the places you can, as long as you ever can, to all the people you can. I haven't got that word for word, but that's the thought. Just do as much good as you can. This can stand as a test, by the way, to sort out the unbeliever from the believer, or the false teacher from the teacher who's teaching the gospel. How anxious is he to do good? How interested is he in good things? Sound-minded, often translated as sensible, as a sense of self-control. We have in there things like modesty, prudence, control of the emotions. It's a steady person, a person that can be relied on. And there's implications about what we think or what we dwell on. Unhappy or unpleasant thoughts or wicked thoughts probably come to our minds, you know. The question is, what do we do with them? Do we brush them aside or do we ponder them more and more? Philippians 4:8 says, finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence, and if anything worthy of praise, let your mind dwell on these things. We have Christians today, and I know some of them, who are into various sorts of wild theories, and they'll take you aside and they'll put their arm around you and they'll start expounding to you. One guy took me aside, didn't think I'd ever get away from him, and his son had written a paper on how the Apollo moon landing didn't really happen, but it was staged in a studio. And the kid had volumes of stuff, from the way the dust was kicked up on the moon to saying it couldn't happen on the moon. You know, his dad was really into this. But anyway, I did escape. I think Nancy might have saved me that day. But that's just one example. We had another man who wanted us to stockpile food and do all sorts of stuff for Y2K in the church. He said, the power's going to go out. We're not going to have any power. I told him, I work in the power plant. Got the best technology of the 50s, tweaked up. I said, nothing's going to happen. If the automatics go out, we put it in manual and we run it by hand. I know, I've done it. Oh, no, no. Well, he was very provoked with us that we didn't advertise that we had food and shelter and blah, 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 blah. But as you all know, Y2K came and went without a bang or a whimper. So, but he was very serious. So we also have people who name the name of Christ, but like nothing better than to be critical of the church. And so you'll see them post an article saying, you know, the church does this, or the church is mean to millennials, or the church should do that. This or that is wrong with the church, got to be fixed. Now, I don't doubt the salvation of these people, and that's not my point. Not my point. But they're into some odd and peculiar theories, and those who love to criticize the church might better work to improve themselves and enhance the church. You know, Paul said to the people that were wives, love your children, love your husbands. He said to the slaves, work for the master and thus adorn the gospel. You know, put a little flourish around the edge of the gospel, because they'll wonder why you act the way you do. In other words, make it better where you are. The sensible Christian does not spend time and effort studying and promoting wild theories. And the sensible Christian understands that the church is an imperfect organization staffed with imperfect people. By definition, it's imperfect. Guess what? If we were perfect, we wouldn't need to come here. We're not ready for crowns around the glassy sea yet. We still have work to do. So, some of these things, like the psalmist said, the first one to present his opinion looks good. They might look good, but when they're looked at in the light of day, many of these things are just not sensible. Zealous believers damage their Christian testimony by appearing to the world at large as being not quite right. Understand, that is the view that the media likes to promote anyway, and a lot of people have in the back of their minds, you know. Christians are a little wacky anyway. And so, if they believe that, whatever the theory du jour is, then how can anything they say about their faith be trusted? But we need to be sound-minded. Sometimes we need to be hard-headed. Look for good, and at the same time, let's be sensible. And a critical Christian is unlikely to bring very many people to hear the gospel if he doesn't have anything good to say about the church. Righteous. It can be translated as just or uprightness. A person like this is honest. They're fair in their dealings. Could be conduct that's approved by God. So a person like this will earn a reputation inside and outside the church. Job was described as a just man. I've known men like that. It's a pleasure to know them. It's a pleasure to deal with them. When I was on the management side of the table, there were union leaders that I could shake hands with and nothing need be written down. Those men were honest men. Now, there was others that if we had an arbitration or hearing of some kind, we paid a transcriber to come in and transcribe it. So we had a record of everything they said, because in a subsequent sort of proceeding, they might say the opposite if it was to their advantage. And let me tell you, the one lawyer that we did that with was very resentful that we got a transcription of the hearing. He knew why I did it, but I didn't trust him. And he resented the implication that he was a liar. But he was. Holy. Holy is a word often ascribed to God. Holy. We can't hope to match the holiness of God. It's beyond measure. It's beyond the comprehension of our limited minds. But as adopted children of God, from Ephesians 1:5, we should desire the holiness which is possible for our limited abilities. And we should at the same time rejoice in the holiness which is imputed to us by Jesus the Messiah. To be holy is an inward condition or inward purity, but the inward condition shines out in outward display. One example is Jesus, who showed his inward holiness constantly by his actions. But you have people sometimes, every once in a while you see an article in the newspaper. Some poor person loses their wallet. Oh, what am I going to do? Every money I've got in the world is in there. And then they go in a store, they go somewhere at a counter and they say, oh, some lady or some man found this and they turned it in. And the person will rejoice and say, it's so nice that there's honest people left in this world. And chances are good that that might have been a Christian that found a wallet and turned it in. Self-controlled. Translated sometimes as discipline, translated sometimes self-restraint. The Greek context implies to hold or seize and then hang on. And it's related to the virtue of sound-minded we already looked at, but rather than speaking to thought life and behavior, it speaks more to appetite, self-controlled. So the person who lives for wine or food doesn't really have this virtue, or the person living for the next sexual encounter. In our age, it could be including persons addicted to drugs, which is more and more of a scourge in this area, more than what I realized, or electronic games. If you go out in a mall, what do you see? Zombies walking down. All they see is the screen. If you drive down the road, who runs you off the road? Pretty hard to do this and drive at the same time. I've gone off toward the ditch more than once. I do not think that that is self-control. If something else aside from Christ is your master, mandating how your time is spent, or taking up the majority of your time, then self-control needs to be cultivated. And, you know, we all have things that take up time. You know, my wife will tell you I disappear and go out in my shop, and it's like she's a widow, because I'm out there until she comes and gets me. You know, and when stuff is taking form under my hands and it goes from a lump of wood into a finished product, I take no notice of time at all whatsoever. You know, I mean, when it gets dark outside the window, then I realize time has passed. But anyway, more likely I hear the door bang downstairs and I hear my wife calling up the stairs saying that I'm needed or wanted for one thing or another. The person also, in verse 9, it says, holding fast the faithful word, which is accordance with teaching. The person must be a dedicated student of the word. And so what we see in terms of an elder is not just a good man. That's part of it. It's not all of it. But for the example for the flock, okay, for leading by example, and for an example of how to serve, the elder has to be a good man. But there's more. Because it's a good man with a certain body of knowledge. This person needs to know the gospel, and the idea presented here is to cling to the gospel, hang on to it, and it's got to be a deep understanding as opposed to a shallow knowledge or surface knowledge. And this means he can explain the gospel and also know enough to refute those who are in error. And he's not afraid to confront error if error arises. No, that's not correct. You know, so I've had, I don't know how many times I've had someone says to me, it says in the Bible thus and such. You know, and after they expound a little while, I say to them, no, it doesn't. I've read the whole Bible many times. That's not in there. Tell me where it is. Well, it's in there somewhere. No, it's not. The Greek context shows a continuing action. And if you want an explanation of Greek verbs, you're going to have to talk to the pastor, because I didn't go to school for that. But it means that the person will just not teach or refute one time, but he's going to keep on doing it. Just as the people in my class, it's hard to get me stopped from keeping on doing it, although the pastor has done that this summer effectively. So he's going to teach what's right. He's going to refute what's not correct. He takes hold of the gospel. He hangs on to the gospel. He grasps the gospel, and he continues to hold on. And so the knowledge is central, and the good man who just knows a little theology is not going to meet the standard. Now, in 1 Timothy, it says, apt to teach. In other words, he has some kind of a gift. He's apt. He's good at it. But here, there's a lot of concern for the content of the teaching, the content of the gospel, rather than the skill of the teacher. He's supposed to hang on tight to that gospel. And it tells us that the gospel, as was taught, was pretty well established by this point in the history of the church. And it was able to be then differentiated from all the other ideas, because there was tons of different ideas and different philosophers. There was hedonists out there, there were Stoics out there, there was all kinds of different philosophies at the time, and they had people promoting them. So in any earlier or pioneer work, the careful and correct presentation of the gospel is crucial, because if a new work starts going wrong, it's very, very hard to get it on track. And so the need for care reflects the new church on Crete and the issues which we're going to talk about later in this series, and a need for sound doctrine. The gospel here is described as the faithful word in accord with doctrine. Faithful shows Paul's message as being authoritative, and it's coming from Paul, but having its source in God. And Paul told them repeatedly, this is not something I made up, this is something I was given. In accord with doctrine means it's being taught or in accordance with good teaching. And the act of clinging to the gospel will enable the teacher to exhort what's helpful. You know, you almost get the feeling, oh, you get bad doctrine, it's going to make you sick. It's going to make you spiritually sick. You won't be well. We got to refute those who may try to contradict, you know. They're bringing germs into the assembly here. Everyone's going to get sick pretty soon. That would exclude all false doctrine, healthful or sound doctrine. False doctrine in that time generally means adding something to the gospel, such as needing to be circumcised or follow the Jewish law. The Judaizers were teaching that, or trying to graft in some Greek mythology that was so prevalent at the time, or removing something such as teaching extreme liberty in Christ so that you could do anything because the body was not important. And the second part of clinging enables a teacher to refute those who are trying to contradict. No, that's not the gospel. That's not what the gospel teaches. The word contradict shows that those who are doing so are false believers and they're promoting false doctrine. But the overseer is to rebuke them or correct them, reveal the falsehood that they're teaching. But they can't be permitted or allowed to continue to try to leave the flock astray. You keep them, you know, you restore them if you can, but you cannot permit them to teach. And so in all of this, we see the reflection of a pioneer missionary work. There's no requirement that the overseer or the elder not be a new Christian. It's probably not possible. Believing children are emphasized as mixed households of believers and unbelievers were probably common. And commands on dishonest gain were reflections of Cretan society and the values at large of that society that Paul did not want to come into the church. On the other side, holiness, uprightness, self-control would be the virtues present in a church leader, or should be present, and hopefully present in church members. Aside from the early nature of the work, there were false teachers there that posed a danger. So, what does that mean to Allegheny Baptist Church? Our church is not an early work. I don't know whether being past 50 you would call it middle-aged or what you would call it, but it's not early. But we do support some early works out on the field, which are starting. And in some fields, like the phrase going to England, the gospel has been forgotten due to secular values. Those fields would be similar in many ways to Crete. Any church anywhere was a pioneer work at one time, whether it's 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And if we look back at the founding of this church, it's clear that the charter members were not only very careful to have the gospel correctly preached, but they were also willing to sacrifice to that end. They were few in number. And I've heard talk about the early days when, you know, they wondered where the money was coming to pay the bills at the end of every month from some of the more seasoned members who have talked with me over the years. But yet, the sacrifices were made, the pastors were hired, the bills were paid, the building was built, and here it is. So, as our church was founded, we look at this advice here from Paul to Titus for a pioneer work, and we see his advice was followed. Now, we benefit today from the work and the sacrifice that brought the church into existence. We're entering into the labors of others when we come here. And we're benefiting from those labors. We're benefiting from that sacrifice. So, with that in mind, with a good beginning in mind, we have to then continue the effort in the same way. So the elders have got then to follow these qualifications. They've got to both lead by example and serve. And by the benefit of that example, the members of the congregation need to emulate that behavior as well. So as the leadership goes, so goes the church. We have a closing hymn now, Cody.